The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The budget passes the Senate. Markets rally 5 for 5. Option expiration for October is done and in the bag, and our guest today is Frank Curzio from Curzio Research. All this and much more on episode number 531 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. Andrew Horowitz here, and it is the Disciplined Investor Podcast that you're tuned into. Thanks for joining me again for another Sunday night discussion that we are going to have regarding markets and investments and economics and all sorts of things in between. We have a great guest today, as I mentioned, Frank Curzio. And Frank has been very active in some of his discussions on a variety of stocks. We're going to get to those and talk about that, as well as I have questions listed up on things like economics, the tax cuts, what's going on with his call from GE and all that. Now, before we get to that, I thought what we'd do is we'd spend a little bit of time on looking at what happened last week. We know that the Dow Jones, the S&P, just couldn't take any beating at all last week. As a matter of fact, it was a perfect week for the S&P 500, up 5 out of 5 days. And that's with one of those days seeing some significant downside pressure midday, down about 0.5%. And then by the end of the day, money was just coming in slowly and surely just throughout the day. And by the end of the day, it turned ever so slightly green to make it a positive day. And that's probably, you know, that's what's been going on. We've seen that there's an amazing amount of money that keeps on plowing into the markets. And regardless of any of the news that may be headline related, that's possibly going to maybe spook people. Nope. Nobody's getting spooked. So what we're seeing is that there is the continuation of this liquidity factor, money on the sidelines coming in. When is it going to end? I have no idea. We know the VIX is showing that there's a lot of either complacency or just relaxation about everything in the markets. Nobody's worried about anything. So right now, what we're finding is that it's better to be long right now and wait for that signal, potentially to get short. Now, I have a lot of signals out there that are showing majorly overbought conditions. I was reading one letter this week that showed that the 14-day RSI is at the highest. It's been one of the 10th highest levels it's been of all time, back to the 1900s. That's pretty significant. We've seen that a few of our internal indicators are flashing warning signs, not hysterical warnings, but just warning signs. But it doesn't seem to matter. The technicals, the fundamentals, all the things that go together, for whatever reason, people are still very actively interested in putting money to work. And I've told you this before. If I've said it once, I've said it 100 times. I think a good amount of that is from sovereign wealth funds from Japan that had to goose their allocations towards equities some time ago. And billions of dollars are still flowing into markets in the U.S. because of this. Yeah, sure, there's a good amount of money from retail as well and institutions. Now we're going to have even more going into the end of the year because where are we? What's going on now? Well, you have that end of year catch up. You have that need to make sure that you're going to get towards whatever benchmark that you're looking at if you're a hedge fund or an institution. And what they want to do is make sure to be on the right side. It would be kind of funny if now is the time that all of a sudden markets roll over. What everybody expects, this is the time of year, the fourth quarter of the year, in October, November, December. This is the time you hear Santa Claus rallies, seasonality is very positive. Wouldn't it be kind of ironic if all of a sudden this is the time out of all times during the year, when October was supposed to be a really tough month. September has one of the worst overall months in terms of performance on history. When we look at that comparatively and relative to other months in the markets throughout the year, wouldn't it be ironic if somehow markets rolled over towards the end of the year when the expectation is that, hey, smooth sailing towards the end of the year? I'm not suggesting it's going to happen. I think it would be kind of funny. It's like whatever the expectation is doesn't seem to happen. So if that's the baseline of what I've seen lately, maybe that's going to be what happens moving forward. Now let's go back and look at some of the things that we saw last week. We saw that there was some better numbers still sloping down. I posted some of these on Twitter. Follow me on Twitter, by the way, Andrew Horowitz, one word. Make sure to follow me. I post various economic reports and quick charts and things like that every so often that you can take a look at. Well, what we saw was existing home sales advanced ever so slightly, about 0.7% for the month. Now they're still showing a little bit of weakness overall. And it is the first month out of three that we did see an uptick on a month-over-month basis. Single-family homes rose 1% in terms of sales. Housing inventory increased 1.6%, but was still about 6.4% under the levels that we saw a year ago. Some of this may have to do with the weather. There's no question about housing and some of the related jobs numbers that we saw lately are very much related to the whole hurricane and the issues that are going on in that area. We also saw that housing starts dropped about 4.5%, a little over 4.5% in September. Building permits declined about 4.5%. And there's some continued discussion about that. Well, you know, we couldn't build over here. We couldn't build over there. We had a week that was off. And, you know, between Florida, there's some fires in California and that area. And just all of those things combined. I don't think I would negate those. I think they are important issues, and I think these are issues that we have to look at when it comes to housing in particular. But also we did see that investment in home building and the home builders' investments were down about 7.3% year over year during the second quarter. Now, in terms of markets, we saw that the Dow Industrials moved up about 2% above 23,000 for the first time ever. The NASDAQ was much weaker. There is some concern about some of the technology companies and some of the reporting that's going to happen in the next couple of weeks. But they were up 0.35%. The S&P gained 0.86%. Gold had its worst week of the month in over a month, down about 2%. And a lot of this, I think, had to do with, well, who's coming into the Fed? The announcement that there's going to be an appointment coming up very soon, and the front runner now, Powell, Yellen's in the mix. We have John Taylor, who is definitely hawkish. But anybody aside from Yellen will probably be considered more hawkish than Yellen. Now, coming up this week, let's talk about this. We have a lot of earnings. We had about 65 companies out of the S&P 500 report last week. About 75% beat EPS expectations. Stocks overall that reported were up about 0.8% this earnings season so far. But we have Halliburton and Hasbro, Kimberly-Clark, we have Logitech, Seagate, and VF Corporation on Monday. Now, on Tuesdays, when we start to see a lot more, we're going to have some of the banks again and some of the financials, Ameriprise. We're going to see AT&T. That should be interesting. Biogen, Capital One, Caterpillar, Chipotle, which just seems to not be able to get out of their own way. Express Scripts. We're going to see General Motors. You saw that stock chart's been just doing tremendous lately. JetBlue. Some of the companies in the airline space last week did very poorly, in particular United Airlines, down about 12% on Friday. Lockheed Martin, which continues to get the benefit of all these major defense spending and defense bills. McDonald's will be coming out. We'll see Sherwin-Williams, the paint company. We're going to see TD Ameritrade, which I have a beef with right now, which if you haven't heard, go listen on DH Unplugged to my discussion about what's going on there. On Wednesday, we're going to see September new home sales. We're going to see earnings from Aflac, Alaska Air, Boeing, Freeport-McMoRan. We're going to see Norfolk Southern. Penske, O'Reilly, Sirius XM, Six Flags, Visa, Walgreens. Thursday, we're going to see Google, or now known as Alphabet, Altria, which is going to be interesting to watch after some of the recent discussion of legislation to limit nicotine. Amazon's coming out, American Airlines, Anheuser-Busch, Baidu, Dunkin' Brands, Ford, Hartford, Hershey. Let's kind of go. Microsoft is coming out that day too. Stryker, Twitter. And then we're going to see September pending home sales also. Now, on Friday, we're going to see the first estimate of the quarter three gross domestic product, GDP, and the month's final University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index and earnings from Chevron, ExxonMobil, Huntsman, Rockwell, Collins, and Weyerhaeuser. So very jam-packed week overall. It's going to be very interesting to watch some of these because this week in particular is a lot of the bellwethers. A lot of the big names that we want to be watching and seeing what's going on are going to be reporting this week. So we need to keep an eye on that and to watch that very carefully because not only are we going to look for what they say in terms of what they did and how their quarter was, but also what their outlook and guidance is. And then on top of that, how their stocks react, what investors are taking from this. Because it's, don't forget, it's not only about looking backwards if they beat the EPS top line or, you know, the top line of revenue or the EPS bottom line. It's not going to be just that. It's important on the first 5 minutes of the trade. But beyond that, what really are we seeing from investors that they're looking inside of the numbers? Are they dumping the name or are they keeping name? Are we seeing a beat, but yet the stock is being sold off? What's happening? Like what we saw with Netflix last week. Netflix beat, had pretty good numbers internally, but you know what? Investors are getting really tired of the cash burn and the stock dropped from about 211 in the after hours. I think it closed about 197 or so, mid to high 190s, let's put it that way, on Friday. So there was a bit of a takedown, nothing major, but still something. So we're going to be watching all of these. We'll come back and talk about that. In the weeks to come and see how that's playing out, particularly when we get some of the analysis of how earnings season is going in totality. You know, the beats on the top line, the bottom line, where the numbers are coming from, is a lot of currency that's helping them along, you know, what's happening here. So something that we're going to keep a watch on because earnings season and really at the end of the day, it's all about earnings for companies. Yeah, it's about liquidity from the Fed. It's about taxes. It's about the interest rate environment. It's about the global environment. It's about regulatory environment. But at the end, really, you've got to look at earnings. That's the important feature. So let's get on to a discussion with our guest today. Why don't we? And our guest today is the ever wonderful Frank Curzio, founder and CEO of Curzio Research. And of course, the host of Wall Street Unplugged podcast. If you haven't listened to that, you got to do yourself a favor and make sure to listen to that. And Frank and I get together quite often. Actually, Frank hasn't been on in about 4 or 5 months, but we talk on a regular basis. So I thought we'd go over just a swath of information. Frank, how are you?
Doing great. Looking forward to coming on. It's been a while, and yet there's a lot to talk about these days, so it's going to be pretty cool. Thanks so much for having me back, buddy.
So we have so many topics to talk about. We have earnings season. We have some of the Fed issues. We have specific stocks. We have the whole tax cut issue out there. So I thought we'd dive into I thought we'd first start off with the concept of economics. And I sent you, I don't know if you got the thing I sent you, on the macroeconomic update that I did just this week.
Yes, I did.
You know, if you look at this and you kind of just thumb through the various charts, there's about 15 different charts. I made a presentation for TradeStation. And if you thumb through there, I mean, is there anything in there that sticks out and says, oh, well, there's a problem? Nothing, right?
Not that there's a problem or there's things to worry about, but you have to remember in 2007, everything was rosy. We were great right back then and everything looked absolutely perfect. And then it's funny how we always revise estimates, right? So GDP can come out at 2.5%, it's a great number. It's going to get revised 3 times, and it could be 1.9%. And, you know, the market moved based on that 2.5% number. It's kind of funny. But everything's always rosy before, you know, it's like a calm before the storm type thing. And I'm not saying that, you know, things are going to get a lot worse. But right now, these numbers, a lot of these numbers are lagging numbers. They're reflecting, you know, a month, some of them 2-3 months ago. And going forward, I don't know if these numbers are going to look that good, especially where we have a Fed that's aggressively raising interest rates, right? We talk about this whole time, right, Andrew, where they had a mandate. First, it was, I think it was like 6.5% unemployment, and we're going to continue to lower rates as long as unemployment is, you know, we need to get 6.5% unemployment. And then we had, 2% on the CPI, right? So the unemployment rate, right, started going down tremendously. They're like, no, well, we're not going to use the unemployment rate no more. And we're just going to use 2% inflation. So even if you're using what the Fed says, it's kind of amazing. I can't explain it. I don't know. Economists can explain it. We really don't know why we're not seeing, you know, just crazy inflation right now, right? With the trillions of dollars that try to inflate this market, we're not seeing inflation on so many different levels. You could actually make the argument you're seeing maybe more of deflation where, you know, no pricing power. A lot of companies don't have pricing power right now. And when you look at that and say, okay, the Fed's going to raise rates even though we continue to be below 2%, we don't have inflation. I think that's one of the greatest risks to the market that we're seeing right now, because it's not the rosy picture. It's not that everything is great. We have healthcare costs through the roof. We have huge debt levels. We're seeing, you know, banks, that regulation hasn't been done. We haven't seen tax reform yet. So you want to see all these things line up when stocks are at all-time highs, right?
Yeah, you know, the thing, though, is let's kind of step back for a second, because you're using, and we all do this, we use assumptions that are about what should be the inflation rate. First of all, the 2% rate is an absolutely arbitrary number that was adopted by the Fed some time ago, just like their 6.5% number that they revised down to 5 and then 4, et cetera, that they kind of just used as a number. Now we can't get to that level, it seems, here in the United States or on a global basis, really. I mean, any country around the world, developed country, that is, particularly Japan, and Europe, those are two that are also doing this whole aggressive cutting and quantitative easing. This 2% number, I don't even, it's like they took it right out of their ass. And that's the number that we're all kind of like, yeah, we need 2% inflation. You know, 2% inflation over a 10-year period is, you know, if you compound that up, things cost an extra 24% over that time period, you know, during that. So there is inflation. It's not runaway inflation. But at the same time, one of the things that didn't happen was when the Fed said, well, we're going to reduce rates and we're going to do all this quantitative easing. Why? Well, we want to support the housing market, which we are seeing about a 5.5% inflation rate. If you look at the Case-Shiller on a 20-city year-over-year basis, about 5% or 5.5% per year over the last 8 years, let's say. Okay. So that's one inflation component. And then we're seeing, you know, food costs go up. We're seeing college costs go up. That's another component, of course. However, they didn't get to their inflation rate by bringing rates down substantially, nor did Europe with them negative rates, nor did Japan with their negative rates. Why do we think that raising rates are actually going to stymie inflation? That's a, you know, that seems to be a misnomer.
It is, but I think instead of looking at it that way, I think we have to look at the bigger picture here. And yes, 2% is an arbitrary number, but the fact is they're raising rates when we're at debt levels that are the highest in our country's history. And that's one of the things that are fueling these earnings and fueling this growth, where companies can borrow money very, very cheap and put it towards other things, whatever it is. They're not putting it towards buybacks anymore, which we talked about for the past 5 years. Mm-hmm. They're doing other things because nobody wants it to be buying back your stock when it's at an all-time high. At least they shouldn't. And, you know, Nike's a good example of that, how much shares they bought, you know, above the current price right now when their stock's trading their all-time high historical valuation. But that's the concern. So we can say, well, this is an arbitrary number and 2%. But for me, it's not even a 2% number. They're raising rates at a time where I don't know if economic growth or we're doing that great, as the stock market suggests. And then as they're doing that, we have debt levels that are incredibly high. It's going to make it more difficult for companies to borrow. It's going to be more payments on a lot of debt that's variable. So we have to be very, very careful here, where is the economy that good where we should be raising rates and aggressively, right? I mean, these guys are like, well, we're going to do it 2 or 3 times, you know, next year too. And I was always on the impression we have to raise rates. They should have been raising rates 2-3 years ago. Now, right. I think they're raising rates to the point where you could immediately they might have to take this back immediately, almost like they did during a credit crisis. If things really, if the, you know what, hits the fan, they might have to reverse this course right away. And you know, Yellen made this mistake before. Real quick here. I found an interesting paper from her in 2007 showing why they should raise rates. And she was part of the Fed. She was obviously the Fed chairman back then. But she was totally wrong, which is fine. We're all totally wrong. But she just had it completely wrong to the point where now it worries me at this stage if we're doing something that we shouldn't. Everything's okay. It's a Goldilocks type economy. Things are chugging along. Higher interest rates are really going to take a growth component out of this when there are also a lot of risks that we're worried about with higher debt, healthcare, and geopolitical risk and stuff like that, that could really result in stocks coming down a lot further, where you're not going to have all that spending, all that money going into these names now.
I guess the big question then is it all about the stock market? Because if it is about the stock market, we know that rising rates so far haven't done anything but help to propel stocks. I think it's also helping the velocity of money, that calculation, and what goes into people getting off of their hinds to go and do something because they're worried about how it may not be forever that we're seeing these low rates. However, the idea that we are in a GDP at about close to 3%, we'll see how that plays out. Earnings at an all-time high. We're seeing that there is, you know, housing has recovered pretty much, you know, around the country back to where it was, in some places much higher. We're starting to see more and more flipping TV shows, flip this, flip that, you know, that whole thing. And I just question the, I do get one of the things. So I understand that the higher interest rates, I think, would be very good for the economy. However, put that into one little quadrant, okay? It will be very bad for debt issues, and particularly the amount of debt that we have outstanding, the ability to refinance and, you know, do any further buybacks, that gets halted a bit. And also, I think it would be bad for the Fed itself with the fact that they have $4 trillion worth of assets that, you know, what are we going to do with these things and what happens to our book of business? I think there is a very much segmented area of where this happens, and that's what they're trying to balance at this point, and that's where their problems come in. But I mean, we can go on with this forever. The fact is that I don't think they should be aggressively raising rates. However, I do think that, you know, getting back up to maybe a 2% Fed funds rate is not the worst thing in the world.
It's not. And let's put this in perspective too, because I don't want this to be over anyone's head. Where, you know, it is, when you see interest rates, think of your house. How big of a deal is a 1% move in your mortgage rate, right? To the point where I was able to, just a 1% move, I was able to refinance and change my 30-year mortgage to a 15-year mortgage and have relatively the same payment. We're looking at a 4% to 5% mm-hmm. rate type thing.
Right.
Now, why is that a big deal? Well, you have all the oil companies who just went through, you know, oil prices just crashed, and what happened? It was a big debt thing. They had to restructure the debt. They were able to easily restructure the debt with low interest rates to push it out to 2019, 20, 21, 22. Now, what happens if the oil industry and prices go down to $20? Just say, all this debt is going to come due, right? So they're not generating money. They're like, okay, let's try to push out. It's not as easy to push out your debt now because your interest rates are higher. So this is where you're looking at some of the headwinds coming forward. So, you know, coming in front of you. So that's why it's such a big deal. You say, well, interest rates, you know, a quarter point here, a quarter point here. But the fact that they want to aggressively raise at least 2 to 3 times every year going forward, I just think they should have did this a couple of years ago compared to now, because if these economic conditions are good, we're fine. Like you said, the market's doing good. It's great. If everything's good, everyone's spending. But you're going to start taking a lot of catalysts out of the market for a lot of these companies. A company like Netflix, I mean, $8 billion in debt. They're going to be negative free cash flow for forever, right? For the next 5 years, probably longer.
Nobody cares. Nobody cares.
I don't know. I mean, we'll talk about that later if you want. But when you're looking at companies that have significant debt, utilities and stuff, it is a big deal. And you're taking that catalyst out of a market, in a market that's at all-time highs where everything's supposed to be clicking perfectly. So that's what I'm a little worried about.
I hear you. All right. With that said, with all of that as a backdrop, okay, let's just for a second talk about the potential handicap. Who's going to be the next Fed chair? So I look at, for just fun, looking at what are the probabilities of the various 5 names that are currently in the hat through PredictIt, you know, predict.it. And it looks like right now the leading is Powell. And we have Yellen that met with Trump. Everybody met with him the last couple of weeks with President Trump. So what are your thoughts? I mean, Warr seems to be a little bit more hawkish. So does Taylor. And it looks to me that this is my thesis, and then tell me what you think, okay? That Trump is going to replace Yellen. And for the reason that he wants his name on the party that is running the Fed. And if we want to keep things as, well, the same as they've been for some time, what we're going to do is we're going to utilize somebody similar like Powell. If we go to a Taylor or we go to a Warsh, there is some potential for controversy there and maybe not aligning with what Trump is looking to accomplish here. What are your thoughts?
I think it's going to be Yellen. I really do. I mean, when you look at his track record, Trump, of picking people, you can't mess around with this position where I think they have a big problem vetting people. That's why you're seeing a lot of hires and all of a sudden something would come out and this person said this and said that. I mean, she's already been vetted. It's a position where you'd like to see that's stable. I don't know if she wants it. I mean, I have no idea, but it would be very good for the markets, I think, because we're all used to this person, and bringing on another person and, you know what's going to happen. The Democrats are going to find something this guy did when he was 17 years old. And, you know, he smoked a joint with friends and look at this and blah, blah, blah. You know, so, and all that is going to be a lot of risk to the markets. And you can't just do what you've done in past position, in past posts where, all right, we're going to fire this guy and get another guy. That uncertainty is going to destroy the markets. That would be huge if you're like, okay, who's the next guy? All right, let's see if we... That's huge when it comes to the stock market and the Fed. So the markets, as we all know, love certainty. We know what we're going to get out of Yellen. We know what we're going to, whether you like it or not, we know what we're going to get. We know what the process is, and it's been that way. And just to change a lot of that, and we've seen Trump where, you know, he's fought with Republicans, he's fought with Democrats, and you know, hopefully he puts, which he probably won't, and nobody ever does anymore, and puts, you know, those party differences aside. But I would rather – stabilization is much better when it comes to the market than anyone else. And it's going to be interesting who he does get. But I'm leaning – hopefully it would stay Yellen, whether you know somebody you like or not. But that stabilization, knowing what you're going to get, is very important to the markets where you may have a lot of uncertainty creep in based on who he hires.
Interesting. And somewhat different. I think Frank's the only person that talks faster than I do.
Hey, we're from New York. Hey, yeah, you got to talk.
New York. We're from New York. Let's talk a little bit about – let's pick up on the discussion of a few stocks here, okay? So let's talk about Netflix for a second here, because Netflix came out with their earnings and the stock immediately went to about 211 in post-market. It's since dropped down a bit. And there was, you know, good numbers. Their domestic ads were a little bit lighter than they've been in the past. Their international additions and subs were really spectacular, actually. However, one of the things inside of the report was concerning, right?
If you look at Netflix... And I've been doing videos for Kersey Research now, which are really cool. I did a lot, did live video feeds, right? And I said, you know, on Friday when they were reporting Monday, I said, Netflix is going to be a good short midday right before the report. Why? Because there was 12 analysts that raised their estimates and target price 1 week before Netflix reported. What does that mean? It means something was leaked, right? I mean, analysts isn't going to go out there. And I mean, some analysts will, you know, if you're not that famous, whatever, you'll go out there, try to make a name for yourself. You really don't know what those numbers are going to be. The fact that there was more than 10, we're talking JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, all the biggest analysts. It was incredible. It's JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, all of them raised their estimates that the expectations were built in to the point where the stock ran up tremendously into the quarter. And I thought it'd be a good short where I said, they're going to report blockbuster numbers. We all know that. Everyone knows that. That's why they're raising their estimates. But there's an interesting trend here. And I'm going to get back to Netflix in a second with earnings in general that started happening last quarter. It's the first time since the credit crisis where the average company that's beating, it's roughly around 70%, Andrew, like every quarter, which you know, of companies in S&P 500 that report beat estimates. Right. It's the first time that after these companies beat estimates and even raise guidance, their stock price did not move higher. The first time that happened, the average stock price did not move higher. Now, what does that tell you is a lot of the stocks have been running up into the quarter. The expectations are sky high. So you look at Domino's, you look at the banks, you look at you know, even Netflix, right? Blew out the numbers, basically blew out the headline numbers, right? We'll look underneath in a second. And then the stock went up a little bit and then it does come down. So that's an interesting trend, and we were right on that, which is cool. But it's just something to think about going into earnings. But getting back to Netflix, there's a lot when you look under the hood that's very dangerous. You can't put this stock and lump it in with the Facebooks, the Apples, the Amazons. I mean, these companies have great balance sheets. They're in secular major growth trends, and you could argue that with Netflix. But when Reed Hastings goes, when you have Amazon, you have Apple, what does that have? $220 billion in cash getting into streaming, Disney getting into all streaming, and you have Netflix sitting on a company that has tons of debt, and Reed Hastings comes on and says, this competition's great.
Yeah, it's awesome. Well, it's wonderful.
It's great. It shows you how everyone's coming to streaming. They're paying $8 billion. That's $2 billion more for content and streaming. They're a great service. I use them. I watch a lot of their programs. They're amazing. Their original content's great. But a lot of companies are going on their own platforms right now. If you look at Netflix, it's a subscriber story. If you look at certain companies, and you know this as well, Andrew, retail companies, it's same-store sales. Sometimes it's not always earnings and revenue that drive stocks. They're looking at a specific metric. You know, it could be debt or whatever. With these guys, it's subscribers. Now I'm looking at them signing deals with T-Mobile, giving away free subscriptions, signing a deal with Cablevision. You get cable, whatever, you know, New York or a lot of cable companies. If you get a free, you're going to get a free subscription of Netflix. That's revenue that may not be coming into them where they're just trying to add subscribers. But the debt number that they have and the competitors coming into the market, you know, you're putting them on the same level as a Facebook and who's, you know, basically tracking everyone, 2 billion people on their platform. And you can't advertise anywhere except for really Facebook, because you're going to get great results because you're targeting exactly people who you want to target.
Yeah, just ask the Russians.
Yeah, compared to just compared to what? Compared to going on television and saying, "Hey, you don't want to." You don't know who's watching, but here, if you're selling, you know, golf equipment, here's a bunch of pictures with pictures. Here's guys here's all these guys right here. And now that, you know, if you're Starbucks here, this person's in your place now. They're in Starbucks. Here's 3 million people in Starbucks right now. What do you want to send them? You can't compete with that with Google or search. They're tracking everything, and it's another story. They'll crack down on that. When it comes to Netflix, I'd be very careful. The competitive threats are coming in, and the amount of money that they have to spend and that debt is getting larger and larger and larger. And you know, it's forced them to have great original content. But what's going on now is you're seeing the greatest actors. They're commanding more money because they can, because Netflix isn't the only game in town. So you got to have to come up with an original program where you may not even get the best actors there either. So it's something that you have to think about going forward. And the fact that no one in the world hates this stock, they all have price targets probably around on average 225. It makes me a little nervous here. I think that, you know, it's a momentum name. It could go a lot higher, and I get it. But when you look at the financials, and we know fundamentals sometimes don't matter with a company like Tesla as well, this scares me. I don't think it should be in the same class as the rest of the FANG stocks right now.
I mean, the story, the one thing that I can say that Netflix, what's interesting about this is when we look at how Amazon did it, where they were basically leaking money and they had massive burn of their cash for some time. They were building out all of their various factories or their warehouses, and they were kind of expanding to a point that was incredible. And then all of a sudden they stopped doing all that and their earnings skyrocketed, right? And the stock did really well. Is it possible that Netflix is doing the same thing? They're building this. I guess the difference is with Amazon, a build of a warehouse is not a recurring item, right? Whereas Netflix, the spend on original content, actors, on production, on new stuff is a recurring, and that's where the big differential is, I would assume.
It is recurring. This is money they have to pay to keep that content, and that's where the danger comes in. And so think of DirecTV, where they had the NFL package, and a couple of years ago, before AT&T bought them, they had to come out and get that exclusive right. You can still get the Red Zone channel and watch that, but the exclusive right to watch everything is DirecTV that they have, and they had to pay a fortune for it. So when a lot of these contracts are up, they're going to have to pay a fortune for it. But you're talking about Apple with $200 billion in cash, Amazon, these companies that are going to be competing for some of this content. And this content can be shown on different platforms and stuff like that. But you know, for Reed Hastings, listen, I've been in this business for a long time, 20 years. When a company goes on and CEO says competition is great for this market, especially competitors that are 50 times the size of us, you know, they have a great market. It's a great company. I'm just talking about the valuation, guys. I'm a fan of Netflix. You know, when I look at their growth model, it doesn't make sense. It's very vulnerable for a company that's trading at 100 times forward earnings. And it, you know, if you own this stock, and even the guys who love it the most, you're looking at 5, 7, maybe 10% gains. They're looking at, and that's the best case scenario. I just think right here, there's a lot more risks than reward by Netflix right now today.
I got it. Well, let's kind of go over to another company that I don't like, which is IBM. I know we've talked about this back and forth. I have not been a fan of IBM due to their incessant requirements of financial engineering in order to keep their numbers looking good. This has been going on for years where revenue has been declining on a regular basis, on a quarter over quarter, year over year basis. And we see that earnings have been holding up and the company seems to be not able to keep up with the latest innovations and technology enhancements, all the things that some of these companies are doing. And IBM seems to be a forgotten, you know, blue chip out there, and they're just kind of a cash cow paying a decent dividend and all. However, you see it a little bit differently, don't you?
Well, here's what I see differently. It's all about the stock price, right? So everything that you just said, we were talking about for the last 4 years about IBM. What does that mean? That if we're talking about it, it's priced in. Now, IBM's a Dow component. And when you look at Dow components, even like GE, which we'll get to in a minute, you know, big story. But when you look at Dow components, they've been in business for 100 years. They see the risks. Everything that you're talking about, they see, right? So they've been through these up and down cyclical markets. And a lot of times, every single Dow component, you can go back. Walmart had a horrible year. Look where they are. You can go to American Express, had a horrible year. It's almost every Dow component gets destroyed and they always come back because they're big companies. They figured it out. They have the cash to do it. With IBM, they're in the server business, service warehouse business, which what, you know, it's, I don't want to say non-existent, of course it is, but it's slowing down tremendously, right? So, and you have the Facebooks, the Amazons creating their own, you have the cloud and stuff. So what did IBM do a few years ago is they said, we have to get into the secular growth markets, which they did, which is cloud, which is big data. And they started off slow, social media, even AI. So they started slow, and now it's accounting for more and more and more of a percent of revenues. Now, the funny thing where, and I love this headline when they say, you know, IBM declined for 22 straight quarters, their sales. IBM was a hardware company. So, you know, if you're selling something for $9 million, generating $10 million, you're going to get, you know, you have that small margin, you know, $1 million, and your sales are $10 million. Now that they're in the services business, it's almost like, you know, paying $3 million for something and generating $6 million. So $6 million is a lot lower number than $10 million. So their revenues are going to continue to decline. Their margins are going to skyrocket because they're becoming more of a services company. They're not there yet. But you could clearly see the transition. And what's good about IBM and why I liked it so much at lower levels is you're getting a dividend that's safe to wait for the transition. And that was one of the reasons why I liked it. And I got a lot of heat when, you know, Warren Buffett is coming out of the stock. And, you know, I don't know why you like this and this and that. And you know, I just told him the truth and said, listen, I'm smarter than Warren Buffett.
Well, that was it. Obviously, for those of us that you know that, of course.
Obviously, I can't hold a candle to Warren Buffett. But following Warren Buffett with technology is, you know, you're almost asking, you know, Michael Jordan to, I won't say play baseball because he actually played baseball.
Yeah, that's a bad example.
To go into swimming or anything.
But, hockey.
Hockey or whatever, where, you know, the guy's the greatest baseball player ever, but you're asking. So when you look at technology and the fact that he bought this, you know, pretty close to $200, and when he did that years ago, I said it's going to be a terrible trade because I hate IBM. But 135, 140 level, I thought it was a great buying opportunity. I almost, you know, did come down lower than that, but now it's back. But IBM, I think, is going to continue to go higher. They're transitioning their business. Everything that you talked about, Andrew, and you have to realize this as an investor, and it's not like I'm a genius. It's because I made these mistakes before, and I don't want to see other people make the mistakes, where everything that you talk about and all these risks are the same things they were talking about 3-4 years ago that IBM knew about. So they're transitioning their business. It's accounting the services and those secular growth markets are accounting more as a percentage. You're looking at you know, cloud growing 15-20%. These are all double-digit growers, big data, and social. And that transition is taking place. And that the fact that the expectations are so low on the stock and all that is really baked in, I just figure it's an opportunity to buy. And I think IBM is definitely bottom. It's going to continue to go higher because that transition, it's like momentum in a train.
Well, this is the equivalent, though, of like an Adobe, which has figured this out a long time ago. They went from... It wasn't hardware, but it was software packages that were very expensive. And they went to a different model altogether that everybody was really concerned about, where they were selling their same software and some additional components of it, but on a monthly subscription basis. And at first it was some, you know, people were having a difficult time really looking at this and looking at what the numbers should be and how it all played out. But Adobe, I mean, look at that stock. I mean, amazing run.
And you bring up a good point. I mean, you could even go to Netflix. How Netflix was just selling DVDs. And they realized, one's even going to buy. Yep. And they transitioned their business model. But going back to what you said, think about Microsoft, guys, when you bought Microsoft Office for the first time years ago. You used to go to Best Buy, go to a store, Circuit City was there, and you had a, you know, they bought the box, they came here, you put it in. Those are huge expenses. Now, today, they're all sitting on a beach and say, you want 365? Okay, go to my website, download it, boom, I collect the revenue. Look at the margins on that compared to them creating the discs, going through the stores, offering those stores incentives to sell their products. When you have a different business model, you may see sales come down, but the margins are much greater. And that's the story that needs to be told on IBM. Not that revenue is declining. I love that fact that they're saying that because it's really meaningless in terms of they're getting out of a horrible, terrible, expensive business and they're really focusing on the growth markets. And they were late to the party. That's why the stock was garbage for such a long time. But they're clearly transitioning and it's getting better. And I think you're going to continue to see that stock go higher. I think they finally figured it out.
Well, let's talk about another one. It's something that you talked about a lot. I'm going to kind of put this in your face. Sorry, bud. But you talked about GE. I mean, you were pounding the desk in May about GE. And obviously, there's been a lot of changes. There's been some management changes since then, I believe it's been. But you were pretty strong on this. And again, this is a big boy. This is a conglomerate. This has a lot of moving parts to it. They're a good dividend paying. They're the quote unquote blue chip stock. This stock has done nothing but just take the guts out of everybody here. Where are you on this today?
Yeah, it's been a horror show. And I'm a big fan of accountability, Andrew. And the last few times you've had me on the podcast, you talked about, you know, how many winners I had and stuff like that and great winners. This is one that I gave you at a higher price and it's down. That's on me. And it's important to address that, right? Because accountability is important. Where I see guys on CNBC talk about stocks and, you know, they'll be wrong and they never come out. With GE, it's been a complete disaster, right? I mean, worst case scenario. I sent an alert to my subscribers from my newsletter, Kersey Research Advisory, yesterday and said, look, the stock's going to come in probably with like a kitchen sink quarter. They should cut the dividend. They don't have to. They don't have to if they don't want to, mm-hmm. but you really want them. So when people say, wow, that's a cut in a dividend, think KMI. Like, it's the whole emotional part of it. You know, it's the headline risk and the stock's going to get crushed. A lot of that's kind of baked in when you look at it, but they're paying $8.5 billion for their dividend. They're not going to suspend it and get rid of it. They're going to cut it. I suggest they cut in half, which I'm surprised they announced today. Everybody knows that it's going to happen, though. It should be baked into the price. I said, that's $4 billion. So you're looking, if they just cut in half, and that dividend is going to be over 2%, which is higher than S&P 500. You have a guy, Flannery, who I know personally, I talked to that worked for him and even told me when he got hired, said, this guy is hard-nosed. This guy doesn't mess around. And the fact that he scheduled an interview on CNBC, and this was on Thursday we heard about it, and knowing that these results were going to come out for Friday, I thought that shows character, right? Because he knew that those results were going to be bad. And he said, listen, this is what we're doing. This is what we're changing the business. With the dividend cut, $4 billion, the fact they could sell transportation, they could sell lighting and generate $20, $30 billion. You're talking about a company that won't have free cash flow concerns for the next 3-4 years if they do. So they have options. It's not a company that's in a bunch of markets that are hard. They're in cyclical markets that aren't really doing good, right? So you have oil and gas, you have power that aren't doing too good, but a lot of the rest of their divisions are doing well. I was hoping that the stock would come out, and we did see that on Friday where it came down 8%. I was hoping they would announce a dividend cut, and I actually said this to my subscribers. I said, well, everyone, you're going to see the headline risk. Everybody's going to be, you know, going crazy, and the stock, you know, I was hoping to see 21, maybe a little bit lower to really, it would have been the biggest position in my portfolio with my conservative portfolio, which is saying, you know, I would have put a lot of money into it because I think just like every other down component that figures it out, everyone that was falling on bad times figures it out. They're going to figure it out. They got the right guy in charge right now, and I think it's a great buy. But early on, I've been wrong on this. But for me personally, in my portfolio, I'm patting the table on it because it's a pretty decent size holding. It will be by far the largest holding in my portfolio. I'm hoping to get a better price. But I was surprised on Friday how, you know, it started coming back after being down 8-9%. And I think we're pretty, that means we're close to the bottom here.
Yeah, I mean, this would be, if we see a little bit more of an uptick moving forward and we then look back on it from a technical standpoint, what you would see is that this was a flush out of the bottom low, and particularly on the pre-market where it came in at to about 21.50-ish or so, and then ramp back higher, getting rid of all the weak hands that kind of flushed out the rest. People were throwing in the towel saying, I'm done with this, you know. That could be a good play. The question, though, is what is going to be, I guess, and this is just a comment, what's the driver that people are going to be looking for, you know, to show that this has sustainability and not just being able to kind of hang in there at that 23-ish level, 22 to 24, we'll call it as a range. You know, what's going to enable it to propel to the next level, which I assume is going to be, you know, continuation of a restructuring, getting rid of some of the crap that kind of is pulling them down, looking to, you know, change a lot of things in terms of how they're doing their business and hopefully, you know, maybe even, as you said, you know, changing things like maybe a slight cut to the dividend to bring in more cash. But again, I don't know if that dividend cut is really necessary. I think that's a lot more fluff. It's not like they're losing money and having.
Well, here's the reason why they should cut the dividend. Because one is the risk is on the table. You had J.P. Morgan come out, who's the biggest bear on the stock, who's been dead right. The analyst's been dead right. His target price is 20, and he's has the worst case. You know, and then Goldman Sachs also came out before the quarter and said, you know, this is to reflect for a possible dividend cut, and said our target price is 23. So even with a dividend then cut, if you take those two estimates, you're looking at, you know, 21-ish, you know, 21.50-ish. So that's the downside in the fact that everyone's talking about it. For me, what I would love to see is for them to cut the dividend and use that $4 billion to buy back their stock at this level. Because you say, well, the valuation's still a little high. And you know, what's the motivation driver? And that's a very important question because Flannery went on Friday and said, look, this isn't going to be quick, right? It's going to take a while. You're going to see progress. And that's what you need to see because you could say, wow, it's going to take another year to fix. No, not when it comes to the stock price, when it comes to the company. The company and the stock price are two different things because right now the company is down 25% for a year, which is a major move for a Dow component to be down something like that for the year. It's reflected that. So if all they need to do with GE at this level is just show progress, just a little bit of progress, and you'll see it go to 24, 25, 26 as they turn around, if power turns around, because if you really look at the numbers in the quarter, power was the big story, which was horrible, but everything else did pretty good. You know, when I'm looking at the numbers, it wasn't even oil and gas. I mean, the numbers weren't bad for a lot of the other divisions. Now you're looking at cutting $4 billion. You're looking at selling off different divisions. If you want to go that route, you don't have to. And then you're not even talking about cost cutting, which the estimates that I have are around $3 billion. So you're looking at $7 billion from a dividend cut and from cost cutting without even selling off your divisions. And you say, where's the value? That's the value of it. And the growth model is, which is, you know, underlying everything else that's going on with this company, is they're going to be the biggest provider of AI, which is scary. It could end the world because all the machines, everything they build is learning off each other. They have big data analytics, yeah. And then they have an amazing cloud platform where they're partnered with everybody called Predix, where they're partnered with Amazon, they're partnered with Microsoft, and every machine, everything they build is going to have sensors, they're going to analyze it, they're going to have machines learning from each other to be more efficient. It's a scary trend when you think about it, but everything that GE builds from here on in is going to have that technology platform. And that whole thing is getting lost in the mix because there's so many divisions that are doing bad. But that's where I see the growth model coming from, a person that's been wrong on this stock. So it's not, I'm putting my ego aside. And if I would say, hey, you know what, just take your loss and move on. For me, I'm aggressively adding and looking to add to my position here. I was just hoping it would go a little bit lower, but I don't know, at least on Friday, and then I'll get the chance.
We'll see. All right, Frank Curzio, hey, thanks for joining us today. Make sure to go and listen to Frank's podcast, Wall Street Unplugged. He has some great newsletters as well that you want to get your hands on. There's some free trials over on frankcurzio.com. Right? That's the right place, right, Frank?
Yeah, you can go to curzioresearch.com or frankcurzio.com. More important, we just added a new feature where we're doing live video on Facebook, and we have all the streams.
Are you going to show your face?
That's the thing. The guys on radio should not show their face, right?
Oh, not that.
But we started doing this, and the technology got up so quick that now we're going to have backdrops, going to look really nice. But it's nice to report live and just from my desk, you know, telling you what I'm seeing during a day. But you get it behind the scenes, and even you, Andrew, it's even when we talk, this is a conversation we would kind of have even if we weren't taping right now. And I just want to get that feel of being behind the scenes of the research, seeing what we're doing. And it's really cool that you're going to see the live videos on a Curzio Research Facebook page. So we're really putting a lot of effort into getting that going. The live videos have been doing good. And you can see my face, which is unfortunate a little bit. And you get to see me make mistakes since it's live. But it's really cool. And the content is top notch. You're not really going to see that type of content.
I'm going to go check it out right now. I'm going to go over to your Facebook page. They're on there still, right?
Don't make fun of me.
Oh, I will.
You better.
The comments are coming out. All right, Frank Curzio, thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you soon, bud.
Thanks, man.
All right, bye. Well, that's some good information from Frank, as always. I mean, you know, Frank brings us some good stuff. You know, not always are we going to be right about a particular stock, but at least we do the research to find out, you know, what's going on with it and how is it playing out in terms of the underlying. You know, Frank's a fundamental analyst. He looks and digs into the companies. He digs into the sectors. He digs into the backdrop of what's the economy and economics behind a particular company. What could be the catalyst? And sometimes what we find is that there are things that are outside of the knowledge base of even the management that is changing things. I mean, just look at what's going on with, for example, a segue into retail. You know, there is maybe some great retail companies out there that have done an amazing job at turning around things and keeping up with the trends, but yet at the same time, they're being shunned by investors as a block. There may be other companies out there that, for example, that if you do all the analysis and you look at the fundamentals and you look at everything that's out there, you say, well, maybe that stock's not such a good stock, but you know what? The stock price keeps going. That's why, by the way, you want to marry the idea of technical and fundamental analysis. You want good, strong companies, and then follow it up with your technical analysis of where to get in and when to get out. Where is that buy point? And those buy points can come from pivot points. They can come from different technical levels like Fibonacci's, or you could look at things like cup and handles that Investor's Business Daily is all about, or, you know, rising from a base and a takeoff. There's 100 different ways to do this. All depends on what you're looking to do. Some people like buying things at all-time new highs where they break out above a major base. Some people like to say, you know what? I'm buying this thing on the dip. When this thing comes back significantly, I still think it's a good company. I'm waiting till we see a correction in the markets, a correction in the stock, and I'm going to buy it there. It all depends. That's what makes the value versus growth game and the technical analysis and the fundamental game all work. But if you can put it together and marry those all together, it works even better, in my opinion. Just a thought. Anyway, we're going to wrap it up here today. Of course, any questions you have, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We also posted some new information about some conference calls we had over on Investology. Did a recent webinar, which I think you really want to take a look at, just go over to Investology and click on the little button on the top that says, hey, webinar replay. Did some technical analysis webinars that we recorded and available for replay on a video over on Trigger Charts. A lot of stuff going on, kind of each of our different areas that we are involved in. We have different sites for just to make it easy and to break it all up. Or maybe make it harder. I don't know. But you can go over to Trigger Charts as well, triggercharts.com, and check out what we talked about the banger setup and about technical breakouts, how to use market profile. Really cool stuff there for trading. Other than that, I'm going to bid you adieu today, and thank you for joining me. I'll see you again next week for sure. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.